Welcome to the Who's Counting podcast with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Hello. Welcome to this episode of Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell. This is a podcast about all things having to do with elections, how elections are supposed to be run, how sometimes they're not run the way they're supposed to be, and what we as citizens can do about it. And one of the things we love to do here at Who's Counting is we love to talk to and find people around the country who are doing great work in the election field, and both experts and citizens. And today we have a great guest that was introduced to me by a mutual friend who lives in Jacksonville, Mr. Dan Bean. And he said, you have to get to know our supervisor of elections who is taking office July 1st. He's a great guy, good friend, Mr. Jerry Holland. So from that, I reached out and he reached out to me and I said, we need to introduce you to our audience. So Mr. Holland, Jerry Holland, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you, Cleta. It's a pleasure. And it is a topic that I really enjoy, which is elections, and looking forward to getting back into it.
That's great. Well, let's start with, tell everybody, you said you're from Duval County, Florida, which is Jacksonville, correct? That's the greater Jacksonville area, I suppose. And tell us a little bit about yourself. You've been the supervisor of elections in Duval County previously. Tell us all about you.
Yeah, I'm actually, it's kind of unique. I started out on our county commission, city council, and our supervisor of elections back in 2004 became very sick and ill, and the governor replaced him with an interim. And at that time, they had a special election, which I ran for in 2005 and was elected supervisor of elections and continued for two more terms until term limits kicked in. So I served 10 years as the Duval County supervisor of elections. And after being termed out, went over to property appraiser, ran for that. My background was really real estate and general contracting. And so it was a natural fit there also. And so I served there for 8 years until I was termed out. And I said, you know, I loved elections. I'd love to go back to it. And I had the honor of running for it unopposed. And so I will go back to the office I held before July 1st.
Well, that's pretty exciting. I always love finding somebody else who loves elections and talking about working in the election space, election field as much as I do. So tell us a little bit about, have you spent much time around the office in preparation for taking office now in just a couple of weeks? Have you had the opportunity to spend time at the office, and any observations about how things might have changed since you were there before?
Yes. I mean, obviously, every supervisor of elections have their own management style. And I don't go in there saying that, you know, what was done was wrong and I'm right. It's just a different style. I do like engaging with the public, engaging with the media. In fact, over the last 8 years, I've been a political analyst for the media. Questions when they came up for elections, became their technical expert for elections. So I've stayed in it, stayed into the statutes, and, you know, made myself very knowledgeable of what was happening in elections. So coming back into it isn't 8 years of not being around it. It's something I've been around the entire time, and often get calls from my other colleagues as far as elected officials asking questions, whether it be everything from contribution amounts to how they do their financial reporting and stuff. So going back in, I'm looking forward to, you know, it's just a reorganization. I think some of the things, the way we ran it back 8 years ago, I'll go back to. We had an education department, which is people in that actually specifically did training and outreach into the community, responsible for that. And so that's one of the areas that we'll make a change to.
Well, you know, I'm really happy to hear that, because one of the things that probably is a change that perhaps did not exist when you were there before, but after the 2020 election, there literally were citizens all over the country who were saying, geez, something happened to our elections while we weren't paying attention. And so there has grown up a lot of citizen engagement in elections. And what we've tried to do, I've been working for the last 2 years at the Conservative Partnership Institute in Washington, as a senior legal fellow, and it really devoted my time to trying to bring people together and train them as to how to be knowledgeable citizens in the election process and how to become essentially partners with their local election offices and not to be adversarial, but to be engaged and involved. Some of the local election officials around the country haven't taken to that very kindly. And so we just always say, you know, be right, be polite, and your job is to try to help, not hinder. So I'm hoping that maybe you can persuade some of your colleagues in Florida, your fellow SOEs, that having citizens involved is a good thing, not a bad thing.
Oh, I think it's an excellent thing. We've had an elections advisory panel here in Duval County since the 2000 election, so for over 20 years. So we've always looked for that engagement. And I, you know, when I look back at the 2020 elections, you know, people often ask me, well, was there fraud? Was there, you know, was the election stolen? And I said, you know, the biggest thing I can see from where my standpoint is was the lack of transparency, was the lack of election officials. And this is not just, you know, in Florida, but countrywide, was the lack of election officials wanting to come out and just answering questions. Why are you doing what you're doing? It's not, you know, people often say, oh, well, they don't trust us. Well, you know, it's our role to gain that trust, you know, and so it's our role to answer those questions. You know, people are going to have different beliefs, you know, and often will want different directions for elections to go. But we have to be transparent. We have to answer the questions why we're doing what we're doing to add, you know, to the confidence in elections.
You know, that was one of the things that I just said repeatedly. The way you restore confidence in the elections and the election system is through transparency. And, you know, there are lots of different areas of that. I know a lot of people don't trust the voting machines. I keep saying, you really don't want to go back to paper ballots. I mean, can you imagine counting all of those bubbles? It's like a bubble test, and can you imagine hand counting? It's not counting just a race. It's all the different bubbles that have to be counted. And I mean, I can't imagine that. But there are things that I think election officials could do to make people feel more comfortable with the election equipment and not have it so shrouded in secrecy. Do you have any thoughts about that? I mean, you were really in the election office at the time when more technology began to be used. Can you talk about that for a little bit and how you feel about the technology and how to engage people and not being so afraid of it?
Well, you're exactly right. It's a balance of using technology at the same time, you know, making the system very secured and those type of aspects when you look at it. I came in 2005. There was still the distrust out of 2000 in Florida because we had the punch card system. It was a very antiquated system, but it was a system that nobody had really challenged because if it wasn't close, you know, most of the times it didn't matter in a sense of how accurate, but it does matter. And the punch card system was antiquated because, again, every time you ran them through the machine to count them, if a Chad was not all the way punched through, it fell out, it changed the vote counts, you know, so there was a move there. It seemed like the country wanted to go to touchscreens. The problem I have with just touchscreen voting is no paper record. You know, how do I back it up and say, how can I count these things if I had to or needed to? That's that balance between having a paper record, but not going to the point of counting every ballot. Again, we're the seventh largest county in Florida, Duval County is. We have just over 660,000 voters. If we have a 75% turnout on the presidential election with 27, say, races on the ballot, that would mean 13 million touches of all the ballots if we did hand counts. You know, it would literally take months. And, you know, that's the other thing people want now is they do want the results and they want them quick. Because as soon as you can get results, there's less of that conspiracy of, oh, you've still got more to count. Now you can manipulate the system to get the outcome you want. So the quicker we can get results is a good thing. You know, in the state of Florida, we do several things. I think an excellent job. One is all our votes are cast such there is a paper record. Even the ones that we use for the disabled voters to cast, the AccuVote, you know, that you know, you use a touchscreen, but it prints out a ballot showing your results. So you can physically hold that ballot, seeing the results. But also some of the technology we went to, when I first came in, we had paper registers, which means when you went into the precinct, you signed a paper register. It had a barcode. In order to give you credit for voting, then after the election, the staff would sit down with a barcode reader and have to scan every one that someone signed to vote. They could scan the wrong one. There was human error in there. Then we went to, obviously, we went to electronic check-ins where we could swipe a driver's license, bring you up, give you credit for voting, automatically updated system. So during the election, during the voting period, we could tell who had voted, not wait until after the election period over. We could see turnout through the process now because of the electronic check-in. So technology really is good. It's not, you know, everyone wants to go from no technology to technology's bad, that balance, where do you go between? So that has been the evolution I've seen during the process, and technology can be good. But I do like a physical record. One of the things the state of Florida does, which I think adds to confidence, is when an election is over, we do random, it's completely random, so it can't be manipulated, but we randomly select races and precincts, pull those out, and hand count them to see if they match the machine count. So it's like, if there's some manipulation in the system, we're going to see if that be exposed somewhere in the process. And if we find something that's wrong from the hand count to the machine count, we will audit more. And then eventually, if we have to, we'll audit the entire election. So there's procedures you can put in to give you that confidence that the machines are working accurately. Not just that we do a logic and accuracy test before the election, securing the machines, testing them after the elections. All those things are security things you put in. It's just not blindly saying, here's the machines, trust them. It's going back and putting a confidence into a hand audit recount of some of those machines.
And all of those logic and accuracy testing procedures, those are open to the public, right? You give notice of when those are going to take place. And you test all the machines, not just a sampling.
Yes. In the LNA test, all the machines are tested. We're running through sample ballots. We know what the counts should be. We run them through, see if the count's that. If it is that accurately, then we zero out those counts. We seal the machine up, and it's ready for the precinct or early voting site. And so, yes, every single machine is tested, open to the public during that entire process.
You know, I've heard some complaints that the software that is used during logic and accuracy testing, then there may be changes after that. I don't really know how. I'm not really a technology guru, but can you talk about that? Because that seems to raise questions in people's minds.
Well, I know even years ago when I was in the office, and this is back sometime after 2005, but, you know, they gave one of the machines, and this was in Leon County in Tallahassee, the then supervisor of elections, Ian Sancho, let a computer hacker come in to a machine and say, can you manipulate this machine so that when I vote for Smith, it gives a count to Williams, and when I vote for Williams, you know, it will give a count, flip the votes and do all those. Hey, any machine is programmable. Okay. That's why, you know, the reality is why you want security, like where you keep the machines. You know, are they under camera and under lock and where you have to have a mag lock to come in? Do you seal the machine and document the seal number? So in other words, it's like I tell someone, if you let someone have access to your bank, and you give them the key to the door and the combination to the safe, and you tell them nobody's watching, can they go in and take the money? Yes, they can. A bank is not secure if you give away all the details and allow them access. In the same way, yes, if you give a machine to someone and allow them to do that. But then again, you're going to know when you do that physical audit of those ballots that there was a problem. You're going to be able to catch that in that process, and you're going to see the seals were changed. The conspiracy to do all this would take a large conspiracy, a large everything working together. It's I never say anything's impossible because, again, people rob banks. So they do break the systems and get in. Can people get into the election systems? But I try to design every system and every operations I do as, how is someone going to try to beat the system? You know, as property appraiser, how is someone going to try to get an exemption they're not entitled to? As election supervisor, how is someone going to get access to this machine? How are they going to test it? How are they going to change the seals? How are they going to get all this? How are they going to beat the audit at the end? How are we going to do all this and keep it secure? You can put the things in place, but if you're going to give the keys to the bank away and the combination to the lock and no one's going to be there at night, then yeah, guess what? You're going to get robbed, you know, but that's the things we have to do to make sure it's secure.
Well, you know, I listened to a presentation a few weeks ago, a couple months ago, really. Some people wanted to show me all these problems in a particular county that proved that it was the voting machines had manipulated the results. And at the end of it, I said, look, I'm going to say the same thing about this that I say when people say, you know, we need gun control. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. And and my view is that, as I say, not as a computer expert or technology expert, but what I thought they were showing me were things that were mistakes, errors, if it were intentional, but it's not the machine, it's the human factor. Just what you're saying. It's if somebody either deliberately or inadvertently does something that is problematic, it just seems to me that you can't blame the technology. You have to blame the operator. Operator error, pilot error.
And you talk about error. You go to hand count.
Oh,
now,
my gosh.
Look how many humans are involved that can create errors, you know, and will they? And there has to be someone not just counting, but someone watching the counters and someone verifying them and all those also being of both parties. It would literally take thousands of people to count as many ballots as we have on a presidential election.
Well, I just think that people are not thinking that through and realizing that. But I do think that the more transparency we can have, and I do fault many election officials and the vendors, the equipment vendors are so proprietary. They're so afraid to let people see what's going on, even away from the election, to be able to have a demo saying this is how this works. I don't know. It just seems as though that your point about transparency is really the only way we're going to restore confidence in the elections.
Well, and there's a move too I wanted to talk about. You know, a lot of people say, let's just do election day voting, you know, and the problem I tell people, in fact, I try to encourage is, and we have early voting 2 weeks prior of early voting. We have right now 19 locations are like vote centers where you can go vote. And you can only drop off ballots if you had a vote by mail ballot at one of those that is watched by the poll workers. So we don't put drop ballots just at insecure locations. They all have to be monitored and have a person there so someone can't gather up a bunch of them and bring in, you know, ballot harvesting or anything. But the key that I try to encourage people why you should encourage as many votes cast before Election Day is there is no tomorrow after Election Day. If the weather is bad, if there's power failure, if there's anything, you don't have that opportunity. Illness in the family, car breaks down. So I encourage as many votes as possible to be cast early voting. If you want to do it in person, vote by mail in the state of Florida is very secure because, again, we check the request for it has to be you're giving part of your social or your driver's license number or you're giving all that information. You can't request for anybody but yourself or your immediate family. It has to come back. We verify those signatures. We have training by former FBI experts that tell us how to verify signatures. We also, again, are making sure nobody else has voted a ballot if someone voted a vote by mail ballot. So again, if people want results and they want them quickly, we can't wait till Election Day and get those results quickly. And that only leads to more conspiracy. In the state of Florida, the governor, the legislature allows us to start counting those votes, the early votes and the vote by mail ballots, as soon as it's about 21 days prior to the election. But what that allows us is election night to put those results right out there immediately. You know, you don't have that conspiracy that we saw in so many states where they still have all these votes to count and this candidate's ahead. And then all of a sudden the votes are counted and they're behind. What happened? Well, that's because you have that time period of going, you know, where are the ballots? Why are they covering up the windows where they're counting ballots? Why are they, what are those boxes for underneath the shelf? All that lack of transparency, which I fault those election officials. I don't know if they were doing right or wrong, but not being transparent to the public leads to the perception that you're trying to hide something. And that's what I don't want in our county. Is I want anyone who's got a question, I want to be able to answer their question. You know, they may want me to do, you know, may only want to vote on election day, or they may not agree with me encouraging early voting or something like that. But the process, I want to be able to show them and show them the confidence in the systems.
Well, you know, I'm a big believer that after 2020, we heard from all over the country, these reports were coming in that people showed up to vote on election day and were told in state after state, oh, Mrs. Smith, this says you've already voted. And so then Mrs. Smith, who has not voted, she's able to cast a provisional ballot, but how do you prove a negative? And so there were a lot of people disenfranchised as a result. And I still don't know how they did it. I don't know how that happened. I'd never heard that before. We heard it a little bit in 2022, but nothing like 2020. So I'm a big believer in, I tell everybody, first day of early voting, go vote in person. Go vote in person. Claim your vote. Yeah, then you don't have to worry about it. You're not doing it by mail. You know, just go vote in person. All the protections are there. And I do worry a lot about the fact that when you vote by mail, the people who are most vulnerable are the ones I worry about, because they're most susceptible to pressure, all the protections about the secret ballot and not having undue political pressure applied to you during your vote. Because if you vote in person, you know, there's no politicking within so many feet of the polls. And, you know, all these protections, they're bipartisan observers and bipartisan election workers. When you're voting by mail, those protections all go away. And so I'm a big believer in voting in person the first day you can, so that you get all the protections and you claim your vote. But that's just me.
No, and let me tell you, I've voted early, I guess, for the last 20 years. And so I do like being there in person. I like doing that. Vote by mail helps some people who don't have access to the polls. That's a good thing. We pay for the postage, so there's no reason even you have to go drop. I tell people, you know, there's a move. Well, we want drop boxes everywhere. And I said, there's a drop box at the end of every driveway. It's your mailbox. We pay for your postage. But for some people who don't have access, what we have noted on vote by mail, especially in our local elections, is that those who request a vote by mail ballot are twice as likely to vote than someone who's waiting to go to the polls. So part of the challenge always given to SOEs, which really we don't have, ours is about access to voting. But a lot of times when the turnout's low, they look at the SOE and say, why can't you do something about the turnout? Candidates drive turnout.
The
media always blames the kind of media likes to blame a lot of people, but the media always looks at the SOE and goes, well, do you need more early voting sites? Do you need more of this? There is a lot of access to voting, but that's the reality is the candidate, and sometimes in races get so negative that people go, none of these people are worth voting for. I'm not even going to go vote, you know, and it gets so ugly. So, but we, at least as election officials, do want to make access to voting fair to everyone. You know, that's another thing, you know, look at is where is the voting locations? Are they accessible to everyone? And again, making sure everyone has that opportunity. And vote by mail is an opportunity for some to vote who may not have transportation, may not be able to, may be homebound. We also go to all our nursing homes and we bring their vote by mail ballot to them with two poll workers, one of each party, and to assist them in voting, to make sure nobody's filling that out for them, you know. And so, again, it's definitely you want security in the entire process. And you want to keep looking at how to make it more secure.
Well, I think that's really true. And there is a balance, you know, but it seems that for a good long while that the push, as you say, from the media and from certain interest groups has just been access, access, access. But you have to balance that. And we certainly saw in some states in 2020 where in Wisconsin, where the requirement for having special voting deputies which required, if you went into the nursing homes, you had to have people designated, one from each party. And the state elections commission just said, oh, we're going to waive that. Well, I don't know how you waive a statute, but they did. And you had some real problems in some nursing homes where they had 100% turnout, even among the memory care unit. So that's the kind of thing that people learn about and they say, gee, something's wrong here. But so I'm glad to hear about how the process works, where you make sure that people in nursing homes have the opportunity to vote, but not subject to that pressure by staffers or political operatives. That always worries me, those vulnerable voters in nursing homes.
And I'll tell you another thing that's a challenge and one of my goals going in the state of Florida, it says in every polling location, there must be at least one person of another party. Now, the current SOE interprets that if it's a person of a NPA, no party affiliation, that's another party. I'll get an opinion to that. I don't interpret it that way. I think it should be one of each major parties. And what I learned when I was former SOE is when I'd only have one Republican and five others were Democrats, the Republican would tell me months later, I don't think they were doing something right. And I'd say, why didn't you call me? Well, I was kind of intimidated. And so my goal is, even though the law says you only have to have one, is to have two Democrats and two Republicans in every precinct so that you can turn to your fellow party person, whoever it is, and say, should we call the SOE? Right. Because during my time, I would fire poll workers. If you weren't doing what you were supposed to do, or you didn't request an ID, or you didn't do something like that, I want you to go home. You know, I don't want to wait till the next election to find another poll worker. I'd have backup poll workers ready to go out and replace them. So it's about putting a lot of things in place to make sure there is no weak links.
Well, you know, and that's one of the things that I've really encouraged citizens to do. And we did a lot of work over 21 and 22, getting people to volunteer to be poll workers and observers and telling them that, you know, we really needed their involvement. One of the problems in some states is they have such long early voting periods. Virginia, 45 days. It's really hard to staff 45 days of voting. It's crazy. And I don't think that sometimes when these interest groups are pushing legislatures to adopt such things, they're not thinking about how to administer an election so that you actually can have transparency and follow the statutes that are in existence that were written for one day, election day, and now they've expanded it for 45 days. That's one of the worst, I got to tell you.
I will tell you, there's a couple things. You know, sometimes, and I used to go to the conferences where all the states would come together, and some of the states you just go, wow, can't we all get together and try to make this better? Because, for example, in the state of Alaska, they're still on paper registers. So they do not count their vote by mail ballots until 10 days after the election. Well, can you imagine if the election was close and it depended on those two electoral votes or whatever in Alaska, and you're not counting even vote by mail ballots for 10 days, go to electronic check-in. Come on, guys, let's get with technology that will advance the system and speed up the process. Because again, if you take longer on the process, it only adds to the conspiracy that you're trying to manipulate the outcome.
Well, and now Alaska has this thing called ranked choice voting, and it is a nightmare. And the state Supreme Court has ruled that the election board, whatever the state election office is called, but that they misapplied the statute. But I don't know how you could ever administer that with any degree of certainty. It's manufactured intentional chaos, as near as I can tell. And that did take a month. It took them a month before they got the results.
Yeah. And so, unfortunately, Florida so far today has outlawed ranked choice voting. There's still a push, you know, from outside interests to try to get Florida to consider that or look at it from municipal elections and all those. And they try to throw you all the plug. I always look when anyone wants to change election systems or the way we vote, what is their motivation and what is their achieved outcome? Because I never hear anyone say, I want to do this because it is a better system. It's always to achieve an outcome. That's and then you true. Have to, for whose interests are you trying to achieve the outcome? So there's always a motivation, you know? And so Ranked choice voting has a way of, again, manipulating the system to get an outcome that would be different if you didn't have it.
I think that's right. And I think we've seen that play out. There's one other area I wanted to ask you about, particularly in light of the fact that you've been in charge of a different agency in the county for the last 8 years, I guess. And that is, there's been a lot of focus over the last 2 years on voter rolls, and citizens have spent a lot of time looking at the voter rolls and even comparing voter rolls to other databases, government databases, and finding lots of problems and duplicates and dead people. And what is your thought about that, since you now have been working for 8 years with other databases from the county? Do you think that you come into your office with a different perspective or an added information and background about how to make sure that the Duval County voter rolls are up to date?
Well, a lot of it will dictate on what our Division of Elections and Secretary of State and the legislature will allow us to do. As you know, Florida was in the ERIC program, and a lot of states have dropped out. And, you know, back when I was in the elections before we had ERIC, I really thought it was a good system, because how else do I know who's registered in another state? So the ERIC did do that. Unfortunately, ERIC also has an activist side. It's like the League of Women Voters, very nice people, and they have a nonpartisan side and they have an activist side. And it's hard to separate the two and have a confidence that you're getting just the part you want. And so the state of Florida decided to drop the ERIC program. I don't know what recommendations so far the Secretary of State and Division of Elections had for checking. Obviously, we get vital statistics from the state. Some of the problems were, if one of our voters died outside the states, getting that statistical information inside. As property appraiser, we use LexisNexis. We use also agencies, tax management associates. We use Deckard. They're people who run the databases to all the other datas, you know, within the country. So the question will be is, and we won't just arbitrarily be able to go out and contract. Elections are very regulated in the state of Florida, that any kind of outside agency would have to be approved by the Division of Elections and Secretary of State. But it does concern me, because getting that outside information of other where they're registered, because in the state of Florida, not necessarily where I'm at in North Florida, but in South Florida, we have a lot of snowbirds, which means they're registered somewhere else and they come down here typically in the wintertime, which is election time, but they could very well be registered in another state. And here, we need to be able to check that and verify that. And so since they've dropped the ERIC program, I have not heard yet what type of databases are we going to be allowed to use to make sure we don't have that. You know, we do a lot of internal checks. When I was on the SOE before, we'd check to make sure, you know, are people at residential addresses versus commercial addresses? Are people also the age? In other words, look at your database. By error, do you have someone that's over 105 years old? You know, check those to make sure, are those people? You know, showed up, we did that, and we had someone who was on the system that was 130. They weren't 130 and they weren't alive, but they had stayed in the system. Because in the state of Florida, if I don't get those vital statistics, then the only thing that I can remove a person from is election mail is non-forwardable. So if the election mail comes back, then at that point, they can be made an inactive voter. Okay. And then after two elections as an inactive voter, you can be removed. But I can't just remove you when the mail comes back. I have to put you in an inactive voter status. So it's a step process as you remove a voter. So getting good data, putting them in that system, put them in the inactive, you know, knowing who's not eligible, monitoring that, monitoring commercial addresses, monitoring also how many people are at duplicate address and same address, but you have multiple families there. That's sometimes you look for the cues that would possibly let you say, and in some cases, it may be valid. You're not and that's nothing, giving people confidence that we don't make a decision. Oh, I don't think you're registered, so we're taking you off. The best we can do is now investigate. And then also, are you there? Then put you in inactive status. Are you voting? Checking those things. Encouraging voters to update their signatures. Because again, when they vote at the polls, vote early or vote by mail. We want to make sure they have the most recent signature we can verify. So all of those things is constantly trying to make sure we have the best data.
Well, I'm glad to hear you say that, because that's the kind of thing that so many volunteers around the country, but, you know, we always urge people, don't start making decisions about, you know, going and investigating voter rolls until you've sat down with your local election administrator. Go sit down and say, what could we do to help you? Because I'm sure, I mean, this is a very tedious process, what you just described. It takes a lot of time and a lot of intent to make sure that you get it right. And so it's interesting to talk to some of these people, volunteers around the country, who've helped their local election offices find duplicates and dead people and provided documentation that then has helped the local election office do their job. Some election offices don't want the help, but I always say, at least start with the idea that you're an ally, not an adversary. And
I think it's great advice.
And, you know, it's proven to be successful in a lot of places. And there are tools that are developing, that citizens are developing around the country, software that will enable an election official or a volunteer to get the voter rolls and run it against another database quickly. And I've learned about all different kinds of databases that exist. But as you say, you have to get guidance from the state office in order to know what databases you can use. But I've learned that there are a lot of them out there. I didn't even realize that until I started hearing from these people who are finding these things. And these people spend hours and hours and hours working on their local voter rolls. It's pretty amazing.
Hey, and I look for that help. And again, at the same time, you've got to tell the other people that are not working on it, we just don't take their information and automatically remove anybody.
Right.
It's information saying we think, and then it's our role to investigate and make sure that that's accurate information. So
right.
Again, as helpful as people are to the other side to maybe think, oh, you're allowing these people to manipulate our voter rolls. No, they're giving us the information. We will share that information. We'll investigate and make sure, you know, that someone's not supposed to be on it, that we go through the step process of removing them.
Well, I tell you what, I wish that every election administrator in America could have a little dose of Jerry Holland, because I think that your attitude is one that I really would like to export, because I think it's really important to have the attitude that you have about openness and transparency and understanding the concerns people have and how you balance access and still maintaining the integrity of the outcome. So everybody can trust the outcome. That's all I ever say. What we have to do is make sure that the process is fair to all the candidates and parties, then let the best campaign or best candidate win, even if it's not my candidate.
I tell people the only time I express my opinion is when I'm in that voting booth, you know, and filling out my ballot. Other than that, I am the most neutral person in the world. Given access, making sure everyone feels like they're, you know, are fairly treated and everyone has the same seat at the table and trying to take all the input. You know, I felt honored to come in this time unopposed, because obviously we're about split 50-50 on Republicans and Democrats, a little more Democrats. I'm a Republican, but not to be challenged really gave a lot of confidence, you know, to this, you know, staff I'm going into, is that people trust that I'm going to run it fair. You know, now talk to me a year from now. I don't know if you will trust me or don't trust me, but at least
a year and a half, November, yes. December, December 2020.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Talk to me after next November. Yeah, I told people, yeah, when I first got elected back in 2005 as a Republican, it was the Democrats who goes, I don't know if I can trust you. Now, believe me, Republicans don't trust their Republican supervisors. So, you know, it's about building trust with everybody and not being partisan when you're in these roles. You know, so I'm looking forward to the challenge and the presidential. Everybody's told me, oh, Jerry, it's changed so much in 8 years. But, you know, the key elements haven't changed, which is being honest with people, transparent with people, listening to people, and treating everybody with respect and the same.
Well, look, I mean, anything that Election Integrity Network, and, you know, there's a great volunteer citizens network in Florida, the Florida Fair Elections Coalition. And I'm certainly going to recommend that they have you speak to their group. They have weekly conference calls, and I'm sure that you would be a breath of fresh air for them to hear you and maybe influence some of your fellow SOEs after you take office to not be quite so reluctant to engage citizens. So maybe you can help explain to some of your fellow SOEs why citizen engagement, openness, and transparency are really the keys to trust.
I will definitely do that.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us, Mr. Holland, Mr. Supervisor of Elections to be. We wish you luck in embarking on your renewed role, and we hope you'll keep us posted on what we can do to help, and anything we'll do to help you. We'll always be here to help you because we like your attitude. We like that approach. I think that's the one we ought to export around the country. So thanks for joining us.
Thank you. And I appreciate the honor of being on and look forward to future calls.
Thank you so much. And with that, that concludes this episode of Who's Counting. We hope that you will subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends and neighbors and get involved in your election process in your local area. Go to whoscounting.us. That's our website. And sign up. Download our Citizen's Guide to Building an Election Integrity Infrastructure. Watch the masterclass videos on how you can be an effective citizen engaged in the election process. And all working together will help save the elections in America. And with that, thank you so much. Thanks for joining us and goodbye.
Thank you for joining Who's Counting with Cleta Mitchell, the podcast about America's elections. Please help us fight big tech censorship. Like and subscribe to this podcast and be sure to share it with your friends. You can become part of this election integrity movement by signing up to join the Election Integrity Network. Go to whoscounting.us. The Who's Counting podcast is produced by the Election Integrity Network.